And it's a simple concept, but it's incredibly powerful because what it does is it actually starts to move an organization towards greater agility, greater customer centricity, more collaboration, more humility, more learning, the kind of culture and the ways of working that tend to be more successful today.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Major Outcomes Podcast. Today we have a very special guest. It's Jeff Gotthelf, and I think if you are in our space, you know him. Jeff is a board member and advisor to a lot of different companies. I think if you're looking for the golden thread in his work, he's always about better products. He helps organizations to build better products. He helps executives to build the cultures and the organizations that build better products. And he has tens of thousands of followers on different social media platforms. So I highly recommend following him there. Always an inspiration. He is an author of several books. For example, Lean versus Agile versus Design Thinking, or also one about Lean UX, designing great products. Quite a impressive range of activities. I just recently learned he does not live at the East Coast in the US anymore, as I always thought, but actually the East Coast of Spain. So in Europe right now. Jeff mainly works with large enterprises of a couple of thousand employees upwards. This is where he thinks he can have the biggest impact and where he can really change and have an impact on a lot of people's lives. As I said, it's a lot. So Jeff, I hope I didn't forget anything very important. Maybe would you like to introduce yourself with a couple of additional information that you care about?
Sure, Johannes, thanks so much for that. That was super kind of you, and it's great to be here. That covers a lot of it. I mean, generally speaking, I've been a designer, a product manager, a team leader, an entrepreneur, and now I work independently, training teams in product management, in Lean UX, in OKRs. And then also doing a lot of coaching and public speaking and writing, working on an OKR book as we speak. And so I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. Nice to be here.
Amazing. Great to have you. So, yeah, I think it makes sense looking into your work to have a focus on OKRs and outcome-oriented planning and prioritization today. So how would you describe OKRs in general? Like, what role do OKRs play in your work?
I think OKRs these days are having their moment in the sun. They've been around a long time. It's nothing new. It's been around about 40 years or so. But I think there's a tremendous opportunity today for the success of objectives and key results because of the capabilities that we have for learning and for course correction and for deploying that learning in a positive way back into the systems and services and products that we make. So for me, objectives and key results are a team level goal setting framework. So it's a goal setting framework for teams that focuses on why we're doing the work. So the objective is the question of why we're doing this. What's the qualitative reason? What are we ultimately trying to achieve? What's the goal? What's the strategy? And then on the key results sides, if we achieve that qualitative goal, how will people's behavior change? And the people that I'm talking about are the people who use the products and services and systems that we build and ship. So we're focusing not on producing features, not on producing output, but on positively impacting the behavior of the people who consume the things that we make and using that as the measure of success. And it's a simple concept, but it's incredibly powerful because what it does is it actually starts to move an organization towards greater agility, greater customer centricity, more collaboration, more humility, more learning, the kind of culture and the ways of working that tend to be more successful today.
That's a pretty well-rounded description. I think you said, right, it's a simple concept, but extremely powerful, something we also experience, however, again and again. It's not just simple and powerful, but also very long way sometimes to actually really operationalize and get it into organizations. So why do you think that is, and how have you seen it work? How do you look at bringing that kind of outcome or customer value oriented mindset into larger organizations, into structures and teams where this might have been not the dominant way of thinking for a very long time, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons why the established structures are rather like having teams lean towards focusing on, yeah, output, features, financial metrics instead of outcome and customer value oriented metrics, business impact versus customer value. Like, how do you get it in there? How do you look at this mindset change? Is it something you can achieve in a couple of years? For me, sometimes it feels like the challenge of the decade, rather.
Yeah, so you said it right. The biggest challenge here is, like I said, it's a simple concept. You're managing the outcomes instead of output. You're setting behavior change as the measure of success. And that flies in the face of the way the overwhelming majority of organizations work today. They work towards features, production, make this thing, get it done by a date, also make sure that it's blue, and I know that the ROI on that is going to be this much, right? Which is just speculation and guessing, and often is very wrong. And so that's really the biggest challenge here, is that we're asking organizations to fundamentally change how they set goals and how they measure success. And in so doing, that actually doesn't sound that hard, right? But the implications of that, as you begin to peel that back, there is a tremendous amount of impact to the whole organization when you change that, right? What do I do? Like, leaders are used to telling teams what to do, right? Build this thing, get it done by Friday. We're taking that away from them, right? Because the teams need to figure out what the best combination of code, copy, design, business model, value proposition is going to be in order to generate the desired behavior changes. In order to do that, they need to know how to do product discovery and lean UX and design thinking and research. And not only do they need to know how to do that, but they need to be able to do that. And we need to accommodate that in the schedule. We have to realize that that's part of the work as well. And so, and this is just the tactical stuff, right? If you look a bit more broadly, kind of more organization level type challenges here, you're changing success criteria, which means you're changing incentives. It means you're changing what people get promoted for, what we celebrate as a company, what we reward. You need new skill sets, which means you're changing job descriptions. You're changing who you hire or how you review people. I mean, it's broad. It just kind of grows and grows and grows. And that is why this is a challenge. I think organizations go into this thinking, oh, I'll just change from outputs to outcomes. No big deal, right? And then they like, oh, crap, this, that. I don't know how to do it. And now I got to change this. So those are some of the big challenges of making this work. I think that if an organization is dedicated to changing and to building in these ways of working, they should expect at least a year to make it happen. It might be longer, and it needs tremendous top-down support. It needs real recognition top-down that this is new, this is different, this is challenging, but that it's worth it in the end. But I will say this, the benefits here, OKRs to me, in many ways, like, if you have strategy, and not every organization does, right?
Yeah, true.
Clear articulated strategy, then OKRs as the next step essentially begin to provide they open the gates for agility, customer centricity, learning, humility, all of the things that make organizations successful today, because we're very clear that the measure of success is not deploying a specific thing. It's having a meaningful impact on our customers and understanding that there is an infinite number of ways to do that.
So you, to someone who's might be a skeptic, right? Imagine there is a executive team where maybe 50%, 60% of the executives lean toward that kind of change, but you also give skeptics a lot of reasons to look at it and they're like, well, that's just too much for us, right? This probably won't work because we have to change everything. So I think a question that comes with that is maybe two questions. Like one, what are some, like how do you start, right? Is OKR something that you start with and then through OKRs, step by step, you can change other things? Or do you rather start bottom up and change things around how teams work in a more operative manner in the actual product and development teams? That's one part of the question. And the second one is like, what from your experience are some of the low-hanging fruits, some of the early indicators it can work? Because I think every organization, I've never seen an organization where it's just like everyone is in. Yeah? You have to convince certain groups. And it's like, hey, this is actually working. We're in a good way.
I think, look, I just described what I believe to be a tremendous amount of change in an organization, right? And change is risky. And there are very few executives who want to take on that kind of change. And so what we need to do is de-risk the change. I think if you run an organization of size, you know, several thousand, tens of thousands, et cetera, type of organization, then certainly you're not going to tell everybody, hey, Monday we switch to OKRs. Best of luck, everybody.
Yeah.
Right? See you later. What we want to do is de-risk the change. We de-risk the change in the same way we would de-risk a product idea, a hypothesis, right? And instead of having a product hypothesis in this particular case, we have a ways of working hypothesis. We believe that if we switch to objectives and key results, we will see these benefits moving forward, right? And so then we want to test that hypothesis. So we de-risk the change with an experiment. Now, experiments for ways of working are things like, well, we're not going to change 15,000 people's ways of working.
Yeah.
We're going to change 15 people's ways of working. And we're going to give them a quarter, right? Not a year, not 6 months. We're going to give them 12 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever it is.
And do you usually, if you say you need top-down support, do you start with the leadership team or how would you pick those 15 or 20 people?
Yeah, so you have to. You have the top-down support has to be, the people have to be aware that this is happening, why it's happening, what the success criteria is for this experiment, how we will know it worked or it didn't work, et cetera. And then we need to protect this pilot team, this experiment team, so that they're not pulled away to do other things, right? We need them to be in this experiment, in this bubble for 8 weeks or 12 weeks or whatever it is. I will say this, I think you should pick the people who are most likely to make this a success for your experiment. And I've gotten feedback before on this idea, people saying, well, that's, you know, the expression we have in the US is stacking the deck, right? Whereas, you know, you're putting in your best players, so of course you're gonna win. Well, if I put in my best players and we don't win, we're going to have much bigger problems, right? So if we can get a sense of how the best players react and adapt and succeed, hopefully, in this new situation, we get a sense of what we have to expect with the rest of the organization as well, right? And if they don't succeed, we certainly don't want to put people who are not particularly, or not as strong as these folks into this situation as well. So pick the team that is most likely to do well with this, and then see what happens. And you run that experiment and you let them figure out how to write these goals and you work with them to approve those goals. And then you let them figure out how to do this product discovery and lean UX and how to adjust course and how to, you know, kill features, for example, right? That aren't going to change behavior that in the way that we'd hoped. And then kind of at the end of that cycle, 8 weeks or 12 weeks or whatever it is, let's review our success criteria. How will we determine that this was successful? What are we looking for? There is one more tip, though, for this. If you're going to run this type of experiment, I will recommend that you do it in the most transparent way possible. Uh-huh. One of the worst things that you can do is build this experiment, this pilot team, and then stick them in a corner somewhere or in a war room or just keep them out of sight from the rest of the organization. Because when they emerge at the end of the experiment and say, we're awesome, we're using OKRs, we're agile, we're customer centric, we've got lots of empathy, et cetera, people will be like, oh, that's great. but I don't believe you, and B, I don't know how you got there. And so if we get this experiment team to publicly broadcast what they're doing, what they're learning, what's going well, what's not going well, where are they pivoting, where are they changing course, where are they running into organizational obstacles, such that when the time comes at the end of the experiment, if they still declare success, we've got a clear sense of where we need to go in the organization to make the next team, the fifth team, the 10th team doing this equally as successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that. I think not just de-risking, but sharing all the learnings along the way. I think the most successful organizations we've seen introducing OKRs or similar approaches to, and then scale it successfully, where these pilot teams, and oftentimes, and I think most impactful leadership teams, shared everything. Also, how incredibly difficult or surprisingly difficult it was for them to actually phrase real outcome and custom value-oriented goals. So I think that strongly resonates with my experiences there. So a bit of a question I get a lot is, like, should every organization actually do that, right? So you seem to be convinced. For me, it seems like quite obvious outcome value-oriented way of planning, thinking about customer value first. Like, sounds like something every organization could do and should do to be more successful, and still most companies don't for a lot of reasons we touched upon. So how do you think about that? Like, should every organization do that, or maybe phrased differently, what kind of organizations do you think can and should do it?
I think that all of these relatively new ways of working of the last 20 years, agile design thinking, lean startup, lean UX, OKRs, yeah, et cetera, all of these have come around to help manage uncertainty. And since the overwhelming majority of our companies and businesses function on a foundation of software and technology, there's a lot of uncertainty to manage in those situations. In the situations of high uncertainty, OKRs work well, agile, lean startup, lean UX, design thinking, product discovery, all of these are tools to help your teams de-risk the next step moving forward. If you find yourself in a situation where your company works in an industry or in a situation where there is high certainty, you know exactly what to build, you know exactly what it's going to look like when it's done, and you know exactly what people are going to do with it, you have a clear sense of how many people are going to buy it, what they're going to pay for it, and what your profit margins are, then maybe you don't need this stuff. Now, I think a lot of organizations believe that to be true. We know everything and we don't need this stuff. But for those organizations that are truly in that situation, then maybe this doesn't make sense for you, right? It feels like a lot of ceremony and a lot of exercises only to learn what you already know. Mm. However, I do believe the overwhelming majority of organizations are working with a large amount of uncertainty. And so therefore there is a need for these processes and these ways of working to get in there. And that to me is the greatest value here, right? I mean, we can't predict the future, sorry, right? The technology changes so fast. I mean, 6 months ago, we didn't even have this whole AI craze, and now the whole world is losing their mind over it, right? Consumer consumption patterns change regularly. Every time we get it, we have something new in the space. TikTok fundamentally changed how people consume social media, right? There are, Amazon changed how people shop, Netflix, how people consumed entertainment and videos, Twitch, et cetera. Like, the patterns change continuously. Yeah. And if we don't approach our work with some level of humility that says, look, I'm confident that I know my domain, I'm confident I know my customers, but the reality is I don't know exactly where the industry is going, then we stand a chance of failure. And I think the tools, and specifically OKRs, are good for that, for de-risking this uncertainty.
So you work a lot with product organizations, right? And in product development, to me, at least from my perspective, there have been like these waves and sort of like agile transformation in product, particularly in digital product development, might have started a little bit earlier in organizations than like talking about strategic agility and OKRs. So what I'm trying to get to is there are some agile frameworks already running, like people talk about Scrum teams, etc. I think everyone has been talking too much about the new approaches to organizational structures, the Spotify model, and so on. So how do OKRs fit into all of that, into other existing agile frameworks that you see running there? How do you make it work? Maybe you can, on a higher level, describe your operating model and the most important frameworks or approaches that need to also tie into each other and integrate with each other from your experience.
I think OKRs form the foundation for organizational agility. And what I mean by that is, if used correctly, if applied strategically and applied, you know, broadly across the organization, the company doesn't have a choice but to be agile, lowercase a, right? Agility is inevitable in an organization that manages to outcomes, that uses objectives and key results, because we set goals as behavior change. And then we start to build, and maybe we test and we learn and we see, oh, this thing that we had an idea for, it's not having the kind of behavioral impact that we need. And so we're going to pivot, or we're going to kill the idea, and we're going to change course, and we're going to try something else, right? Course correction based on evidence is agility, right? Is agile, right? That's the fundamental philosophical change here. The specific processes that you use to enable the agility of your organization are going to vary. We've got plenty of starting points, right? We've got XP, we've got Scrum, we've even got SAFe. If you'd like to go down that path, which I don't recommend. But the point of all of this is that if you have a foundation set in outcomes as the goal, agility almost inevitably follows, right? Because we can't be rigid about what we're going to make. Because if we're rigid about it and it doesn't achieve the outcome, the behavior change, then we've wasted a tremendous amount of time and effort and money and resources and all of those things. And so for me, it's a base layer. I hate to use the phrase process stack, right? Because I don't know that I like it, right? But if you visualize it, right, I think the foundational layer, well, the foundational layer is strategy, right? There has to be some organizational strategy. And then on top of that are the organizational goals. Those are going to be your OKRs. And if you do that well, then the agility follows, and you can call it by one of its brand names, or you can make up your own name for it, or you can pick and choose the pieces that you like from each of these frameworks and just make it work inside your organization. So to me, it's foundational. It's not the only way that agility can happen. I don't think that that's true, but I think agility is inevitable with OKRs as the goal setting framework.
Got it. As we talk about frameworks and change, and I think a lot of the work you are doing is transformative. So what we see a lot in that context is that frameworks are being implemented, change is being implemented, and still the why, the purpose of that kind of change seems to be either, worst case, missing, or but in many cases, at least not clearly communicated to the company. So what do you experience in that context? Like, why do you think that happens? How do you support organizations there? What can be done so everyone understands why OKRs are important and why change needs to happen?
That's a good question. I think I'm thinking through sort of the clients that I've had, and the change has come from leadership. But I don't recall any of those leaders being clear and deliberate about why we're making the change. When I'm brought into the process, I make a case. I'm more like a lawyer defending the change, right? Like I'm the advocate for the change, right? And I start to talk about the benefits and why this is good and why I think you should do it. But, you know, I think it's really important for leadership to come forward and say, we're making this change because we've been struggling with, you know, improving the agility of the organization. The pace of change in the market is really high these days. We are taking too long to react to those changes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we believe that this is a way for us to start to correct that. I think that would go a long way, especially in organizations that have been around a while, because I've been to so many companies over the years where, you know, legacy companies that have been around 50 or 100, 150 years, and you've got folks who work in those organizations for what feels like 50 or 150 years sometimes, you know, but you've got those folks, and I walk into a room and I'm going to teach one of these frameworks, you know, train them in one of these frameworks, you know, they're sitting back there like this, arms crossed, leaning back in their chair, you know, basically almost literally saying to me, I'm going to wait you out, right? I've been here 25 years. I've seen people like you come and go. Nothing ever changes, right? So yeah, whatever. Yeah, do your little dance and then leave, and I'll just keep doing my job the same way I've always been doing it. And look, I don't blame that person. No, that's their reality, and that's kind of been the experience. And I think without a clear articulation of why we're doing this and what success looks like from leadership, I think any kind of change in certainly OKRs is going to struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think we made it clear OKRs do play an important role in your work. And you told me earlier that you are actually writing a book on this topic. So can you talk already a little bit more about like why that book and maybe what kind of spin it will have? What will be the subject or the idea of this upcoming book?
Yeah, so it's a book about OKRs. The title is still in fluctuation. But the purpose of the book is that this is a how-to manual for every employee in the organization. So not just product managers or designers or engineers. This is for HR. This is for legal and finance and marketing. In other words, if your organization is rolling out objectives and key results, this is the book we want them to put into every employee's hands. Like this is how, this is what it looks like. And this is the kind of the guidelines that we are following when it comes to deploying OKRs in the organization. And we believe that that's missing in the marketplace. There are a few standout books on the topic. There's Measure What Matters, which is kind of the executive inspiration book by John Doerr that got everybody talking about it. There's Christina Witke's Radical Focus,
exactly,
which is a fantastic book on the topic and speaks to it kind of at the single team level and maybe at the startup level. And there's a couple of books by Ben Lamort and some others around coaching, how to coach OKRs, but this kind of like employee handbook for how to do it. We don't believe that that exists and we're writing it.
Nice. You also told me, because I'm passionate about writing, and I asked these kind of questions, some of them already before our podcast conversation. You said you usually write with others. And what does that mean in your case? It's like we are writing it. Like, how does that work? Who do you work with?
Yeah, so I work with Josh Seiden. I've written two books already with Josh Seiden. We wrote Lean UX together. We wrote Sense and Respond together. We started a book publishing business together, and so we edited about 20 books together, and he's been my friend and my business partner for 15 years at this point, and we're writing the OKR book together, and the reason for that is we work really well as a team. We have complementary personalities. So for example, I'm a jump out of the airplane and build the parachute on the way down kind of person. And Josh is like, wait, 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 we should at least take the ingredients for the parachute with us when we jump out. So he slows me down, I speed him up. And we've over 15 years of collaboration and friendship, we've developed a very trusting, a high trust professional relationship, and one where whenever there's an issue, neither one of us is afraid to bring it up. You know, because generally we get along, but we clear the air very quickly. Nothing festers. No one gets mad. You know, I'll give you an example. Just last week, I was traveling, and Josh had to cover me on a couple of work related engagements that I was supposed to teach with him, but he was covering for me. I forgot to tell the client, and I forgot to update the Zoom link, because usually it's my Zoom link we had to update it. You know, but that's bad when the client shows up on my Zoom link and I'm on an airplane, right? And so immediately when I got off, I called him up and I apologized. I said, look, it's my fault. I totally forgot about this. We've got a couple more of these in the future. I'll take care of it, right? But it's that kind of trust and transparency that builds a great collaboration ultimately. And look, I think certainly both of us have egos. I think that both of us recognize that we're more successful together. And so every now and again, your ego is going to take a hit in that, and we're okay with that.
That sounds indeed like a great foundation. You always seem like, you know, like being a lot on stages, events, but also work with huge companies. So is that also when you consult and when you help managing those larger transformations, that you usually work in a network of partners like that? Or how do you fit in? What we oftentimes see, right, is like, oftentimes there's a trigger event, there's a new strategy, there's a new leadership team, there is probably one of the three or four big consultancies that have been there before. So where do you usually come in? Like, how do you work there? Is that a rather network-based approach, or is it always the same three or four people? I think that's something that's really interesting for our audience as well.
Yeah, so one of the best things that I've done since I went into solo practice was start a private Slack channel, small one, for people who do what I do for a living, or, you know, or are in very close adjacent roles. But basically, everyone is an entrepreneur. Everyone is generally working solo, and then everyone is working in Agile, agility, design, product management, OKRs, lean startup, that type of thing. That group, one of the things it's taught me is how to manage community, which is really hard. But I feel like I've dialed it in now. We've got a great group. It's a highly engaged, very high signal to noise ratio in that group. And that's always my default starting point. Like if I have an engagement that I know I'm not going to be able to fulfill by myself, that's my starting point. I go in there and I say, look, this is what I've got on my plate. I need help with X, Y, and Z. Anybody interested in pitching this with me? And then usually a couple folks will step up pretty quickly. And that's assuming, of course, that Josh isn't enough. I always start with Josh and then move over from there. But that's been great. That's been a tremendous resource. And it goes both ways, right? Those folks do the exact same thing when they need help or they can't fulfill something. Oh, I've got this, you know, I was asked to give a speech at this all hands meeting, and, you know, I can't be there. It's too far away. Whatever it is, does anybody want, you know, can I recommend anyone for it? So that community has been tremendous. And that's where I start.
Great. Understood. So Josh is the default.
Josh is the default
partner, but yeah, there's a network. Yeah. I'd love to learn more about your publishing business as well that you have there, but that probably doesn't fit in here today. But as you are an author, as you work with books, I have to ask you, I think that's one of the last questions already. What are some other books that you might recommend beyond your own books, of course. We will put links not just to your profile, but also to some of the books we mentioned into the show notes. So everyone listening in here today can dive deeper from there on. But I'm sure you have other ideas, other recommendations of some of the greatest books you would recommend.
Teresa Torres' Continuous Discovery Habits is a great book, a fantastic companion to Lean UX, and a all about product discovery. So that one's fantastic. I'm still a big fan, even still in the sense that it's been out a while, but still a big fan of Barry O'Reilly's Unlearn. I think that that's a great book. Mm-hmm. Josh Seiden's book, Outcomes Over Output. It's a tiny little mm-hmm. book. We published it as part of our publishing business.
Who's the author there?
Josh Seiden. It's Josh Seiden.
Okay.
His book is tremendously valuable and powerful, and it continues to do really well. So those are three that come to mind immediately.
And we are on a podcast today. Do you also have any other sources, like podcasts you're listening to, people to follow in that space that you would recommend besides you and Josh?
I always like ourselves. Look, the interesting thing with podcasts, I'll be honest with you, I love being on podcasts. I struggle to listen to podcasts.
Got it.
That's for me. Like, the only time I have to listen is, to podcasts is when I'm exercising. Usually, I mean, I've got kids and family around the house, and so it's hard to just put on a podcast typically. And so if I'm exercising, though, it's going to be music more often than a podcast. So I don't have a great recommendation, because every now and again I'll listen to a podcast, but I don't listen to a lot of them. I'm sorry.
Fair enough. We'll stick to books then.
Yeah.
Okay, then last question already. Like, what's your preferred way to engage with people? How can people reach you? We have lots of listeners who are managers, who are leaders themselves, who are maybe other consultants working in these kind of transformations that we talked about. Like, how can they find you? How could they reach out?
So a few ways. LinkedIn, connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm very active there. Twitter, still on Twitter at this point.
Yep.
Been there a long time. Yep. We'll see how that goes. That's a good place to go as well. Email, you can email me. You can find out on my website. It's super easy. And then I would say my newsletter. So I write a newsletter every 2 weeks. It's an original article every 2 weeks, typically on the topics of OKRs or organizational agility, product management, that type of thing. And so I would highly recommend signing up for that as well.
Cool. Some more links that we'll put into the show notes.
Yeah.
Jeff, that's it already. Thank you so much for your time. It was a real pleasure. I hope we might see each other in Spain next time I'm visiting our colleague there. And then, until then, have a great time.
Take care. Johannes, this was great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe to the Major Outcomes podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other major platform you might be using. Also, we'd be excited if you'd leave us a review. This helps us grow the community and spread the outcome mindset. See you on the next episode.